Welcome back to Behind the Headlines from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell, and technically I'm talking to you from the past. I recorded this voiceover on Friday when the forecast said Sunday would be in the 70s. Knock on wood, we reached that, and you're enjoying it right now. Now, it's not every day you get to interview your boss, let alone your boss's boss. As most of our readers know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel was one of the papers recently purchased by Gannett. Editor-in-Chief George Stanley sat with me to talk about the purchase, what it means for the paper and for its readers. First question, what was your reaction when it was announced that we were being purchased by Gannett?
Well, the initial reaction was shock, you know, because we'd only been a new company with Journal Media Group for a year, actually less than a year. It was announced a few months after we became a new Milwaukee-based newspaper company with the Scripps newspapers. So we thought that we were probably going to be an independent company for at least 2 to 3 years. And then when Gannett spun off its TV and separated it from its newspapers, they immediately began looking to grow, and we were their first acquisition.
Did you have any concerns when it was announced?
Sure, you always have concerns, just like our readers have been telling me about concerns about, will this make you less local now that you're not based in Milwaukee? Will this change you from, USA Today is a made-to-be a newspaper that very quickly gets to the point for people who are traveling and visiting other cities and things like that. Does that mean that the Journal Sentinel is going to become less thorough, less investigative, less comprehensive about local news? And it doesn't, but those are the types of things that concerned me and our staff, just like it concerned many of our readers.
What would be your response to people who are criticizing the fact that we are no longer locally owned?
Well, very few media properties are locally owned. So, for example, WTMJ, which used to be part of our company and stands for the Milwaukee Journal, is owned by Scripps of Cincinnati, Ohio. And so very few companies are locally owned anymore because there's been such a change in our industry with technology, so much competition that local newspapers, for example, can't get national digital advertising really anymore because there's so much giant competition out there from Facebook, from Google, from huge enterprises. So our business model is changing. Who we are as a business is changing. And you have to be big to survive in that world with technology to grab a large audience. And Gannett offers the largest newspaper news company platform in the country. It has the most subscribers. It has 100 million unique daily visitors, and that's growing with our acquisition. And they're hoping to get to 150 million unique daily visitors, which is about half the population of the United States by the end of this year. That's a company that can play in that world, and we were just too small to do that.
All right, so going back, you had mentioned that there had been some concerns expressed by people in the community about this acquisition. What were those concerns, and how did you respond to them?
Well, people who had lived in other Gannett cities in the past, because, you know, Gannett has 10 newspapers in Wisconsin already, in Green Bay and Appleton and Wausau and Sheboygan and places like that, were concerned that we would not be the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel anymore. But a team of Gannett editors has come in and met with us, spent much of this week with us, and is teaching us about how to use a network, for example, to as a bigger platform for stories that go beyond Milwaukee, but we'll still be making the decisions about our news coverage in Milwaukee. We'll still have our local staff of reporters just as strong here in Milwaukee. And that's what I'm going to be writing about for our readers this Sunday in a column, is how when these big stories happen, we'll still give it everything we've got. We're still going to be the place to come for everything from arts and entertainment, sports, from the Packers and the Brewers and the Bucks and the Preps. I think we're actually going to get stronger in some regards with our new partners in that. And we'll still be a locally run operation with local reporters and local editors.
So let's say you're in an elevator with someone who's on the fence about subscribing. Mm-hmm. And maybe not just because of this deal and perceived notions of it, but the paper, because of the recession, because of cuts, has gotten smaller or whatever the reason may be. What is your one-minute pitch to them about why they should subscribe?
Well, with the while the printed paper has gotten smaller, the what comes with a print subscription is also a digital subscription, and we do more overall work than we've ever done in a very timely manner in all our digital platforms as well, including video, including things made for your smartphone, so the easy access, including informational graphics that are better ways of explaining stories, including audio like this. We have many more ways of telling stories than we ever have. And what we do that you can't get anywhere else in Wisconsin are in-depth, explanatory, investigative stories and projects that no one else in Wisconsin has resources to do like we can. So, for example, when we find out that babies are dying and suffering because of sloppy newborn screening practices, we're the organization that can write about that and lead to huge changes immediately by our own health institutions in Wisconsin and then nationwide to save those lives. When we found out that Milwaukee had the worst, and documented that Milwaukee had the worst mental health care system in the nation, and we went to other places from Giel, Belgium to Madison to Houston, Texas to find better operations. And we presented those and gave our community a pathway to solve its problem, and it's made huge strides with that. We found $60 million in fraud, in taxpayer fraud, in subsidized child care, and uncovered that and exposed it. And the government did nothing about it for 10 months, and then we put everyone responsible's name in the paper and phone number and email, and the citizens demanded that they fix it. And as a result, just as many kids that are eligible for that program are getting child care today, but it's saving tens of millions of dollars every year that was going to fraud that we uncovered. So, and then that's not even counting our arts and entertainment coverage to find out what you're going. We're going to do the best summer ever this year to give people advice on where to go. The Green Bay Packers and Brewers and sports coverage we do that's so much more comprehensive than anybody else. So the business coverage, you know, we have the biggest business news staff. So we can explain stories like, you know, it took entrepreneurs to build Milwaukee into what it is today, and it's going to take entrepreneurs to make us thrive again in the future. And we did stories like It's a Time to Build that focuses on the entrepreneurial spirit and the daring and what the city might be able to do and the state might be able to do to encourage more of that. So we're looking for stories that matter to our community and make a difference and improve people's lives. And I think that's a great reason. By subscribing to the paper, you not only read that and learn all about it and become a better citizen, but you support that work.
George and I talked for 16 minutes. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, I was unable to include our full interview in this segment. However, you can find the full interview with his column on jusonline.com. Milwaukee has policies intended to help a homeowner keep his or her house while satisfying code violations or short-term tax problems. However, these policies have been abused by some inner-city landlords who have turned the loopholes into a business. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporters Carrie Spivak and Kevin Crow investigated this. Here's what they found.
Today we're speaking with Carrie Spivak, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Carrie specializes in investigative reporting. Carrie, Milwaukee has a serious dilemma with negligent landlords. The problem seems to have developed when landlords began taking advantage of a loophole. And that's kind of where your investigation comes in. Can you tell us more about your recent reporting and the original intention behind the policies that are now in place?
Sure. What we're basically doing is we're looking at building codes, enforcement of building code violations, both by the city and by the city court system, the municipal court system. And the codes are created basically to have decent properties for people, for renters to live in, and force the landlords to bring them up to code. And if they fail to do so, fine them if necessary.
Okay, these policies were originally put in place to ensure that homeowners keep their homes?
Right, for when they, in terms of the fines, if a landlord has a fine, they don't want to put the person out of business, especially a smaller landlord, so they may give them time to pay off a fine. If you have a $5,000 fine, pay $500 every 6 months or whatever the judge and you can work up.
Okay. And how did some landlords find a way to take advantage of that little system?
Sure. There's a couple of ways that they did it. One is going to a judge and having tens of thousands, even six-figure amount of fines, and asking and coming in and saying, "Judge, I can't make those payments. I'll offer $100 or $200, whatever is agreed, every 60 to 90 days. And that way it goes on for a long, long time before it's ever paid. Other landlords just don't pay it at all, knowing, again, because the city doesn't want to put people in jail for no reason, they realize that there's not a whole lot of consequence for not paying it at all. And the other thing, part of the kind of loopholes that they've been finding, is occasionally not paying their property taxes, knowing that the penalty for that is not going to be that egregious.
So then how do some of these landlords manage to make a profitable business out of this loophole for themselves?
You rent out you milk the property. You rent out the property. They do make improvements on there. They will on occasion, they will make repairs when told by the city, but they may take their time in making those repairs. And they may do them just a minimal amount. But meanwhile, you're bringing in rent from the tenant. And if you get tired of the property starts outliving its usefulness for you, you stop paying your property taxes. If you stop paying your property taxes, after 3 years, the city's going to take the property back from you. Now, for a person who doesn't pay the property tax on their home, that's going to hurt. You lose your house. But if you have 50, 100 properties and this one is no longer making money for you, what do you care? And besides that, when the city seizes the property, your tax debt is erased.
So, Carrie, can you tell us a little bit more about how some landlords use this loophole to create a business?
Sure. And there's a full circle they can make. There's a cycle here. It starts every Monday morning at the sheriff's sales. That's where properties where you did not pay your mortgage foreclosures are sold, often very cheaply. They can buy a property there. So you have a guy who on one hand is going to the judge, say on Thursday, saying, "Your Honor, I cannot pay the $5,000 fine that you issued. I need more time for that." The judge says, "Okay." And then on Monday morning, that same person may be at the sheriff's sale buying more properties to add to his inventory, which he would then rent out, may or may not make the repairs, may or may not pay his property tax.
Caught in the middle of all of this is the tenant. And what have you seen through your reporting? What are some of these tenants going through?
Well, if a property isn't kept up to code, it's the tenant who pays the price. If there's mold in a house, if there's faulty electricity, windows that don't open, the tenant is the person who's living there each day. Even if the landlord ultimately fixes it, and as I said, they frequently do, but the tenant might be in that house for an extended period of time living under these conditions with no real option to do anything else. And it could be overpriced as well. I mean, we had one house, it's been brought up to code, But one house that when we were there had what appeared to be mold in the basement, windows that didn't open, a storm door with no window or screen, electrical violations, etc. She was paying $950 a month rent plus all utilities.
So, Carrie, what could be done or should be done to help fix this problem?
It's a tough one because there's a lot of moving parts. The sheriff's sale is ran by the sheriff under the directions of the state legislature. The municipal courts are part of the city. They're levying the fines. They cannot tell the sheriff, don't sell to people who owe the city money. There could be changes in state statutes to that effect, but that would be a difficult one. There's also the question, and we spoke to the mayor, and he spoke about this a little bit, that perhaps the system the judges use of giving you time to pay your fines, that's good, especially when dealing with the small person you don't want to put out of business. But when you're dealing with a guy who's a frequent flyer, is running up tens of thousands of dollars in fines, perhaps you should be a little tougher on them and not give them so much time to pay a fine, to pay off their fines. There's also the question on municipal warrants. The judges will issue arrest warrants. Nobody's afraid of those warrants because by court policy, you have to have four interactions with the police before they could even consider arresting you. What happens the first four times on a municipal warrant is they can bring you in and give you a new court date. Only on the fifth interaction with the cops will you actually be arrested. So there's not a whole lot of, that does not instill a whole lot of fear in one's heart.
Carrie and Kevin have more on the story online, including an interactive graphic demonstrating how the game works. You can find that online at jsonline.com. Keep an eye out for more on this story in Monday's edition as well. This week, our beer writer Kathy Flanagan was out and about for Beer Week. After sipping some rare brews and pouring a few herself, Kathy talks to art critic Mary Louise Schumacher about the beers that took her taste buds away and how the event has evolved. So, Kathy, we're actually right in the middle of Beer Week. By the time our audiences hear this, Beer Week will be over.
Sad. So sad.
So, it's been a busy week for you. You've been doing a pick for every week. Tell us what Beer Week has been like for you so far as a reporter.
Well, it's been crazy. It's been fun, and it's been a lot different than it's much more different than the first time I ever heard of Milwaukee Beer Week. Because I know more beers, and I also think the crowds are bigger and there are more opportunities to drink good beer. But it started out well. It started out with a really, really nice day at the Vanguard with Surly Beers, and then Crafts and Drafts, which is a beer festival that helps benefit the Wisconsin Ovarian Cancer Alliance. Mm-hmm. I had to think of that. It's a really well done festival, and I got to pour there, and that was awesome. And then
you were pouring beers?
I poured beers.
What was that like?
It was so much fun.
It's not something reporters usually have to do, is go and actually pour beers for people. So what was that like?
It was great to be on the other side. I poured some rare beers. I was in a group with three other people. We were behind a bar at Serb Hall. And I poured, the first one I poured was the So Here It's Tuesday from the brewery in California.
Okay.
And people lined up like 10 minutes before we were even going to start pouring. You know, it's weird how much beer is like Disneyland. Mm-hmm. Everybody stands in line to get 1 ounce of this certain thing, and then they're done. They get in another line. So they stood in line to get this, and I tried a little bit.
What'd you think?
It was delicious. A little sweet, but it was delicious.
Mm-hmm.
There were, you know, it's a chance to try. That's what it is. A chance to try all kinds of beer. That's mm-hmm. what festivals are good for.
Mm-hmm.
And Beer Week is sort of like a festival that runs all week in different places.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any new beer experiences yourself that were really standout experiences?
I did. Oh, you're going to ask me what it is. And it's it's Five Rabbit does a beer that's named for a character in The Princess Bride. And it was the balance of flavors in this beer was so spectacular.
Can you describe it a little bit?
Yeah, it was a barrel-aged beer with notes of vanilla and coffee, and it was just perfectly balanced so that you didn't get too much bourbon forward and you didn't get too much coffee forward. Everything was just exactly as it should be. And I hadn't had that style from Five Rabbit before. And best of all, it was poured in my glass by Randy Mosier, who is an expert on beer, is one of the owners of or the investors in Five Rabbit, and is writes books about brewing and tasting beer. So,
is Beer Week a really social thing too? I mean, are there big crowds? Do people hang around and kind of talk about what they think about these beers? What's it like to be at these events?
That's typically what it's like, and that happens at festivals as well. I mean, on Friday there's a new group called the Craft Brewery League, and it's an alliance of brewers in Milwaukee who are sort of taking advantage of this explosion in craft beer here, and they get together and they serve you tastes of their beer, and you get to meet them, and that's what happens in Beer Week. That's what's going to happen all summer at festivals. That's the fun of it. You can talk a little bit about the beer with the person who brews it or created the recipe or monitors it or started the brewery. And for beer geeks, that's really fun.
Kathy covers the culture of beer every week in the Journal Sentinel's beer page. You can find that at jsonline.com/beer. Look for upcoming beer events, including opportunities to sample in her weekly Beer Here column. If you're running a company and have a job opening, speed matters. That's what recruitment specialists are saying. With the economy approaching full employment, competition for candidates is rising. Twiddling your thumbs while making a hiring decision can mean losing the candidate you prefer. The Journal Sentinel's Steve Jagler explored the changes in the hiring landscape with recruitment experts for his C-level column. Jagler talks with Bob Friday about those changes.
Steve, do you get the sense that most employers can adjust to this new, quicker hiring process, or is this a case of turning around a battleship for them?
I think they're going to have to make a very deliberate and disciplined change in the way they approach their brand as an employer. The experts we spoke to said that every employer has a brand out in the market. And I think employers need to pay particular attention to their brand now more than ever, certainly more so than since the Great Recession hit.
Beyond making quicker decisions, what other advice do the people you talk to have for employers? Do they need to do more now than in the past to sell themselves to prospective candidates?
Yeah. Staffing people emphasize that enlightened employers now are speeding up their interviewing and hiring practices and not waiting as long once they think they found the right candidate. They say that talent is now in the driver's seat with a labor market that is tightening and at almost full employment. Talent has more options now than it did even 2 years ago. And so it doesn't just happen accidentally. It needs to happen deliberately, and employers need to step back and assess what they're doing and how they're doing in terms of recruiting and retaining top talent, and they need to be competitive.
So in a sense, does it sort of turn around the jobs equation in the sense that it's employers now who have to sell themselves to candidates and not the other way around?
Absolutely. The talent is in the driver's seat is a phrase that the staffing experts kept coming back to this week, more so than even 2 years ago. People have options. If you're not going to give your employees, a competitive working condition and working standards and even wages, somebody else will.
When you had discussions with your sources for the story, did you run across any examples of an employer moving too slowly and actually losing a candidate?
Well, one of the staffing people we spoke to for this column said that the companies they were working for, their customers, they had experienced that, they thought they had the right candidate in hand, but their standard practice was to maybe call the references and, yeah, we'll get back to you later. And when by the time they got around and went through their customary processes, that candidate had perceived that lag time as indifference on the part of the employer and had accepted a different offer at a more nimble employer who was ready to act more quickly.
Anything else, Steve?
Well, this week's column, it really touches on an issue that's central to the mission of the C-level column. What we're trying to do is get behind the news headlines. The headline here is that the labor market is tightening. But what we want to try to do week in and week out is address the how and the why for executive decisions. Why are they making these decisions and how are they going to execute them? And those are the things that we want to drill deeper down on week to week.
Read Steve's column in Sunday's Journal Sentinel and at jsonline.com. On that note, I'll wrap up this week's show. Once again, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening to Behind the Headlines. Join me next week as I take you behind the scenes at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.